Hello, everyone, and thanks for hanging out with us for the Behind the Numbers weekly listen and e-marketer podcast made possible by mParticle. This is the Friday show that reviews the most, let me tell you something, media and retail news stories of the week. I'm your host, Marcus Johnson, in today's show. Stores on wheels.
Unless you can, you know, put a Walmart on four wheels and start wheeling it around a neighborhood, then I don't really see how this concept can really scale beyond, you know, the basically convenience store factor.
Netflix cracks down on password sharing.
Given the flexibility of these services, people will unsubscribe, subscribe, unsubscribe again. It's just not going to happen. People would be up in arms. And unless there's collusion and everyone does it, it just won't happen.
Spending less time with ad-supported media.
You know, I think consumers are going to go back to accepting the subsidies offered by advertising as they start feeling the costs of these services in a way that, you know, there is a cost, obviously, to an ad-supported service, but it's not as clear to the consumer, I think.
Welcome to the Netaverse, an unpopular opinion about podcast listenership and an important fact about America. All right, folks, join me for this episode. We have three people. Let's meet them. We start with senior analyst on our retail and e-commerce team. It's Blake Josh.
Hey, folks.
Hello there. We're also joined by one of our directors of forecasting. It's Oscar Orozco.
Hey, Marcus. Thanks for having me.
Hello there. And finally, we have one of our directors of reports editing. It's Rahul Chada.
Hey, folks. Nice to be here.
There he is. What do we have in store for you? Well, folks, four segments on the menu as per usual. We start with the story of the week. Stores on wheels. We'll talk about whether they'll catch on. Then the game of the week for our contestants, Rahul, Blake, and Oscar. We'll go head to head to head. Give us the best takeaways they can to try and win the championship belt. We then move to uncommon knowledge. We'll talk about some unpopular opinions. And in our fourth segment, dinner party data. We'll talk about things we just recently learned that have nothing to do with our work. The best kind. Anyway, we start with the story of the week, stores on wheels. Last week, we talked about a new robot that is on wheels that goes around and you can swipe your credit card, open up the lid and take your item, basically a vending machine on wheels 2.0. And so I wanted to kind of continue this theme because there was this article we didn't get a chance to talk about. And it was a recent piece in The Economist that asks, why should shops, restaurants or other facilities be fixed in place? Coffee shops or food stands could restock at a central depot and then migrate to business neighborhoods in the morning and entertainment districts in the evening, suggests Shano Hart, an architectural designer at the University of California at Berkeley. Mobile shops selling items such as shoes, clothes, or cosmetics could visit particular neighborhoods on a regular schedule or when hailed by a customer. Ms. Hart was saying it gives us flexibility to reassign space. So it's the idea of why does the store have to be there Monday through Sunday? Why can't it just be there Monday, Wednesday, and Friday? Why can't stores roll into town on a schedule? Or when you press a button, you can call the store to your neighborhood. Gents, the idea of larger stores on wheels, any thoughts?
I don't know if this was addressed last podcasts, because I wasn't on it. My invitation must have been lost in the mail or something like that.
I assumed you would have listened. That's a shame.
No, if I'm not directly involved, I have no interest. But did anybody bring up this? Because I know that, you know, some of my colleagues were with me at the NRF show in January in New York, but there's this interesting startup called RoboMart. I don't know if that was addressed, but it's it's a cool concept. It's basically an autonomous vehicle that is stocked with convenience store items. Like there's one version of it that's like snacks and like treats and stuff. One version of it that's like over-the-counter medicine. And basically you just hail it like any ride-hailing app and you have the app and you request which version of the car you want to come to you and it comes to you and you take out the items that you need from it and it charges you through the app and then it's just on its way. And I think it's in beta in some areas of Los Angeles right now. So that's an interesting concept, right? But in general, why do all stores need to be in place? I think the obvious reason is that when you look at, you know, these quick commerce startups like GoPuff and Getter, their biggest issue is that they have these micro fulfillment centers, but they can't provide an assortment of products. Like, you know, having a full scale retailer, people like convenience that like to be able to shop in one place to get everything they need or most of the things they need, that requires a lot of space. So unless you can, you know, put a Walmart on four wheels and start wheeling it around a neighborhood, then I don't really see how this concept can really scale beyond, you know, the basically convenience store factor.
And really quickly, that robo car or device we're talking about, that is a car size, or is it like a small car? Is it more of a...
It's called RoboMart, and it's about the size of, like, you know, in like, these are like really popular in Europe, those like Mercedes-Benz vans, like that have the like minivan rolling door. It's like that size. I think it actually is that. Yeah.
Okay. So, I mean, what do you guys think? Because I mean, I'm envisioning either... Well, I guess some idea of, you know, how you have kind of like a food truck area, like something similar to that, but for more for retail, where, and you have that, you know, you have certain areas. There's one in Austin where it's a bunch of like trucks and they're basically selling things, selling apparel out of these trucks. But one that where it was kind of a more regular cadence, like you had certain items that just wanted to be sold in the summer. And so that truck was just there in the summer and then it vacated that lot and another retailer came in that was on wheels selling things in a different season.
Yeah, I mean, I think I agree with Blake. It seems like the main restriction on this idea is product category. This RoboMart, obviously, they are appealing to people who make maybe impulse purchases at a convenience store. I'm not sure what other kinds of product categories outside of maybe, you know, a food truck, like you mentioned. I was just at the beach and, you know, I think the kind of stalls that people set up to sell, like, I don't know, maybe a beach hat or sunscreen or something like that. I think that could be an interesting example, but the idea of a vehicle like this, it's like kind of what Blake was saying, it's at odds with the idea of the infinite shelf that the online shopping experience offers. So, you know, I think the retailer has to be really judicious about the inventory they're going to carry and also who are they actually trying to target to make these purchases.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree with both of you guys. The first thing that came to mind was sort of the pop-up shop idea, right? Which, in my Brooklyn neighborhood, I see them. We have a sort of a retail area where they pop up every once in a while. You know, that's what I thought of. But for me, I don't have any industry sort of data that that tells me how successful they are. I really think of those, again, like everyone's saying, as this connect to eventually kind of the online e-commerce space. So it's more of like a marketing situation, take advantage of introducing people to your product, but eventually it all kind of just leads back to online shopping in the end. So I don't make too much of this like the rest of the guys. Mm-hmm.
Okay. It did get me thinking that maybe, I mean, shouldn't most stores be pop-up? Like, do most stores need to be there year round? A lot do, I'm sure, but I feel like there could be more room for a store. Maybe if it was more of a white label store, you could come in and it wasn't customizing it exactly how you wanted because that's expensive. Even though we've seen, you know, you see conferences that just, you know, appear out of nowhere and then disappear a few days later. I wonder whether you'll have more kind of basics, like kind of looking stores, and companies can come and just fill them for, you know, a month, a week, you know, 6 months or so, and then vacate. And it's the idea is that they're much more ephemeral.
I thought of a limited edition, for some reason, sneakers popped up into my head, but something like that, if it's like a limited edition product or maybe some sort of service where, yeah, people will flock to it for a, you know, a limited amount of time and it'll be super popular. But that's the only way I see it working.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think it's interesting that idea does short circuit, I feel like, in a lot of ways, like the kind of research and discovery phases of the path to purchase. But if people do know that the store is coming with a cadence and like there's a limited product drop, like Oscar was referencing, yeah, that could be an interesting example of somebody who's kind of figured out how to do it in an interesting way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Final article, gents, we were reading, there's no global shopping mall, notes Shira Overday of the New York Times. Shira's writing that many apps that Americans use are also popular across the world, at least outside China. Facebook, Google, TikTok, Uber, Netflix, etc. Are shared global experiences. But shopping online or in stores has remained mostly local. People around the world don't all buy tea kettles and t-shirts from a shared big retailer like Amazon or China's Alibaba. We may never do so. She was kind of pointing to this idea that, you know, Walmart, it's a big deal in America. It's not popular outside of North America and Central America by and large. And it's hard for, it seems a lot harder than maybe was expected for a lot of these online players to be as international as perhaps they'd like. Or any thoughts on the idea of there never being a global shopping mall and actually a lot of the shopping that we do is still very local, or a lot of people want it to be very local?
Yeah, I think it is really interesting when you look at companies like Amazon and Walmart that have clearly made the investments in other countries, but haven't been very successful. But the main difference between retail and a lot of these other apps that have gone global is that retail is inherently physical. So it requires some sort of presence, mm-hmm. whether it's a, you know, a fulfillment center or distribution partnerships that make it a lot harder to scale than compared to if a social network wants to expand in a new country. I mean, that's all they have to do is basically, you know, spend on marketing in order to drive people to download the app. They don't have to actually set up a physical presence. So mm-hmm. I think that deters a lot of the smaller players from looking into international expansion. But then with the Walmarts and, you know, and the Amazons, I think it's just that idea that especially in nascent markets, people are just so used to shopping local. Oftentimes these are, you know, they give business to the people that are in their communities that they know. And if I think if it's a country that is developing, those sort of interpersonal relationships are still a lot more highly valued than they are in maybe the more developed world where we're already used to these more anonymous transactions.
Yeah, part of the article I thought was staggering. They were saying about Amazon. It seems as though Amazon's going to be in every country around the world as much as we read about it. But they were saying Amazon's financial disclosures show that nearly 90%, 90, of its yearly revenue comes from just four countries. The US, Germany, the UK, and Japan. 90% of the money Amazon makes comes from just four countries.
That was fascinating to me. Yeah, I mean, I think the Forrester analyst did a great job within the articles mentioning three key reasons why, you know, retail can't be globalized. It was, you know, government rules favoring locals, a local expertise, and then just the low barrier to entry for, you know, small mom and pop shops. But I think it's so much more complicated than that. We could talk about this for days, but, you know, I think a couple other things, it's so costly and there are so many different product categories. How could a retailer, no matter how big it is, come in and manage to, you know, sort of overtake or provide all of those different product categories for all the different shoppers? And yeah, the local inspiration part. Yeah, every shopper is so different in every country, but also markets within the country. So there's many, many reasons why this is likely never to happen.
Yeah. Yeah. Susharita Kadali, she had some great points. The Forrester analyst that Oscar was referencing, she had made some really good points in the piece. That's all we've got time for the story of the week. It's time now for the game of the week. But first, a quick word from our sponsor, mParticle. At the end of the day, your customer has to be at the center of everything you do. This starts with the right customer data strategy, as well as the right foundation to solve the challenges that typically inhibit success, such as data quality, data governance, and connectivity. mParticle is your real-time customer data infrastructure that helps you accelerate your data strategy by cleansing, visualizing, and integrating your customer data from anywhere to anywhere. Ultimately, better data leads to better decisions, better customer experiences, and better outcomes. See why the best brands choose mParticle. Go to www.mParticle.com. All right, folks, we are back. It's time now for the game of the week. Today's game, what's the point? I've got to come up with a new game at some point. But for now, what's the point? Where I read out four stories and have contestants, Rahul, Blake, and Oscar, tell us what they think is the main takeaway of the story. Okay answers will get you 1 point. Good answers get you 2. And answers that give you the same feeling as when you go to a movie and you have the whole theater to yourself. Answers that leave you with that feeling, they get you 3 points. Each person gets 20 seconds to answer before they hear this. Whoever has the most points wins gets the last word. We start with Rahul. Netflix cracks down on password sharing. After years of turning a blind eye to password sharing, Netflix is making moves to charge users who share their accounts with people outside of their households, writes Gareth Vipers and Alison Prang of the Wall Street Journal. The streaming giant is testing a new feature that will charge customers an extra fee for the ability to share accounts. Netflix will trial these changes over the next few weeks in Chile, Costa Rica, and Peru before introducing the changes to other countries. But Rahul, Netflix cracking down on password sharing, what's the point?
I think Netflix has to try to figure out how to increase its revenue as its subscriber growth slows. At the end of the day, I think all this might have the effect of driving users either to other streaming services or, you know, I was reading a thread on Reddit where people were reacting to this bit of news and piracy was looking increasingly like a good option to them now. I mean, I think that's probably a small subset of consumers, but I think it is reflective of the fact that it's probably going to annoy people. And, you know, if your sister's ex-boyfriend still has your Netflix password, you know, you might see people switching up their passwords a lot more frequently to get rid of the hangers-on.
Like, yeah, I mean, I think it's potentially a big deal. It doesn't feel like with all the competition and a lot of the content that Netflix has lost over the last couple of years to its competitors, that they are going to be able to do this without taking a hit. What I'll be really interested to see is if other streaming services follow suit, or if they're going to use this as a way to, you know, market themselves against Netflix.
Mm. Oscar.
I'm going to be a bit more firm than my colleagues here. I'm going to say this is never going to work. It's not. I did a little bit of research in preparation for this. Pew found 2 in 5 online adults have shared passwords to online accounts with friends or family. Lightman Research Group found that more than a quarter of all video streaming services are used by multiple households. It just won't work. There's already high levels of churn that would go up. Given the flexibility of these services, people will unsubscribe, subscribe, unsubscribe again. It's just not going to happen. People would be up in arms. And unless there's collusion and everyone does it, it just won't happen.
Nice answers, gents. We move to our second round. We start with Blake. Spending less time with ad-supported media. Time spent with ad-supported media falls to 46.6%, even as ad spending soars, writes Joe Mandis of MediaPost. Of all the time spent with media, the ad-supported share fell to its lowest point ever in 2021 and is projected to continue falling over the next several years from 47%, that 46.6 that I mentioned, from 47 today to 43%. By 2025. That's time spent with ad-supported media, even as spending by advertisers continues to rise, according to MediaPost analysis. Blake, spending less time with ad-supported media, what's the point?
Yeah, I mean, we'll defer to Oscar and the rest of the forecasting team to maybe shed a little bit of light on what is driving this change. But I think, you know, overall, it's something that we've known for a while is that, you know, if there is an offer to have an ad-free experience, a certain swath of consumers are going to prefer that. And if there isn't another tier that offers ad-supported, so a lot of the, you know, popular streaming services like, you know, Netflix, Disney Plus don't have an ad-supported version right now. So I think it's basically just, I would guess that that's sort of what's driving the change.
Oscar.
Yeah, this one seemed less complicated on the surface than it did as I read into it a bit more. I'm not quite sure how they classified services by, for example, services that have both ad-supported and subscription, right, side. So that was a bit unclear about that. Yes, people are spending less time with things like print and traditional TV, which are very much entirely ad-supported, shifting to digital. But, you know, it's not just subscription OTT services that are doing well. We were seeing it with ad-supported services as well. Things like social media, online, a lot of this is ad supported. So I kind of don't have much else to comment on. It's a bit unclear, but yes, I guess we are shifting a little bit towards non-ad supported. I don't think that article is being very clear with the methodology though. Yeah.
Fair. Rahul?
Yeah, I have the same problem. I think if we're assuming that the increase in time spent with non-ad supported media is reflective of people increasingly watching SVOD services that don't have ads like Netflix, then it kind of makes sense. But I also think just, you know, as we're talking about Netflix, the prices of these services are going to rise. And a lot of these companies, Disney Plus is probably the one who's gotten a lot of attention for it, or planning on launching a tier that has ads on it as well. You know, I think consumers are going to go back to accepting the subsidies offered by advertising as they start feeling the costs of these services in a way that, you know, there is a cost obviously to an ad supported service, but it's not as clear to the consumer, I think.
Mm-hmm. Move to our third round. We start with Oscar. Has the tech magic gone? The bubble hasn't exactly burst, but we're no longer seeing a fantastical belief in the power of technology, writes Shira Overday of the New York Times. She notes that at this point, meaning today, but in 2021, this time of year in 2021, technology was eating the world and stock markets, but now, not so much. Tech superstars like Facebook, Alibaba, and Tesla have slipped down the ranks of the world's most valuable companies. Cryptocurrencies are falling in price. IPOs are mostly on hiatus, she points out. Miss Overday thinks that folks have thought the tech bubble had burst before, and they'd been wrong. But this time feels a little different, perhaps. Oscar, has the tech magic gone? What's the point?
I don't think it's gone. I think all within context, right? The stat I honed in on was the NASDAQ index of the top 100. Tech stocks has dropped 14% from the end of December. That's a big number, but let's keep in mind, is this just a sign of overvaluation? You know, we have seen this bubble grow and grow and grow. So are things just kind of, you know, coming back a little bit? But you know, I think that's what we're seeing here. We're not seeing us move away from tech, or that tech is still not driving the global economy, and especially the U.S. one. I do think it is. Let's remember, all within context, too, we're dealing with a major inflation crisis, a war, we're still in a pandemic. So with all that in mind, I think that this is overblown.
Rahul.
I'm a out-and-out skeptic. I feel like a lot of times we're all laboring in a collective delusion. You know, I think there are all these like made-for-streaming service movies now about WeWork and Theranos. I think there are evidence of that. Scott Galloway reported recently, he's a professor at NYU, some interesting data that showed that the companies with a price-to-sales ratio of greater than 10 hit 15%. This is within the S&P 500. So that's more than 15% at the end of 2021. And he's taking it as a sign that we've already exceeded what that percentage or share was prior to the dot-com boom around 2000, 2001. So yeah, I think we're still in the bubble. I'm just kind of waiting for it to burst. When will that happen? I don't know. I might be shorting a lot of stocks if I knew that.
Blake.
I think that, you know, context is really important, because a lot of these tech companies did phenomenally over the last couple of years, a lot of it driven by the pandemic and shifts in consumer behavior. And I think that it's only natural that we're seeing a tapering effect, included with all of the, you know, inflation, the war, just the sort of lingering, you know, negative side effects of the pandemic, just all happening at the same time. So I think that might be a little bit premature to say it's the end.
We've got one more round for you, and we're going to start with Rahul. Welcome to the Netaverse. The first NBA broadcast with volumetric video was shown a few weeks ago. What does that mean? Well, during a Brooklyn Nets basketball game against the Dallas Mavericks, video technology from optical company Canon used over 100 data capturing cameras placed around the court to track player movements and turn the broadcast into video game style graphics. So you're watching the real game, but the players and the court look like a video game. Why? It lets you watch the game from a bunch of different angles that you can't quite get with real cameras, at least not now. But Rahul, welcome to the Netaverse. What's the point?
I mean, I have no idea. I'm not a sports guy. I read this article and I was like, yeah, why bother watching the actual game? Let's just all watch
next.
A simulation of
what. Moving on.
I will say I would watch it if they added special effects largely drawn from the game NBA Jam. Like if you could put a Darth Vader mask on James Harden, or like turn a Steph Curry three-pointer into like a fireball, I would watch that.
The Monster Jam. Blake, what you got?
Yeah, I agree. I am struggling to find like why they are doing this in the first place. Like, if you want more camera angles, then like just add more cameras and like figure out a way for people to control it on their own. Not sure why anybody would want to, you know, deal with the physical labor of directing the game when, you know, the broadcast should be doing it for you. But I don't understand. It seems like this is sort of like a piece in maybe something larger that we can't really see yet. That would maybe be cool, I guess. Or maybe it's just dumb. I can't say.
One of the two. Oscar.
Yeah, I couldn't make sense of what they were describing. I watched a little clip of it. I mean, the graphics aren't great. I don't see why anyone would want to watch that rather than the real life game. Unless they let me, you know, through the metaverse, jump on the court and shoot around with them a little bit. Yeah, I can't see why this would be really cool. Yeah, it's weird.
Yeah. My first thought was kids. That young people so into video games might want to watch the game this way, perhaps. But outside of that, yeah, I couldn't understand the play. Anyway, that's all we've got time for the Game of the Week. This week's winner Who could it be? A drum roll. Blake is this week's winner of the Game of the Week. Very close. But congratulations to Blake. He wins. He gets the championship belt. And of course, the last word. Well done, Blake.
I'll just use the last word to keep going with my train of thought in this NBA Netiverse thing.
Okay.
Yeah, I just feel like maybe kids will like it, but I don't think we should be, you know, maybe enabling these bad instincts for, you know, children. And that just reminded me of that. That's something that I, you know, miss our former colleague, Mark Dolliver, because I would love to hear his reaction to this Netiverse story. So I guess if Mark is listening, shout out to Mark. We miss you.
We do miss you, Mark. Where the hell did you go? Anyway.
Living a much better life than we are right now.
Yeah,
he's probably on a beach in Greece or something like
Not wasting his time on this podcast. fair play, Mark. You did well. That's all we got time for the Game of the Week. Congratulations to Blake. He wins the championship belt. Before we move on, quick word. Behind the Numbers, we now have a monthly giveaway. Oh, ooh. Don't get too excited. Where we'll be giving out 2 free mugs. I don't know why I've downplayed it before I've even read out of it. Get excited.
It's very exciting.
Love of God. Yeah. It's very exciting. Ooh. Mugs. We're going to be giving... Okay, don't...
If you drink hot beverages, this is
from these things. Okay, so we're going to be giving out 2 free mugs a month. If you can answer the question of the month, which I'll randomly announce on an episode, any episode, and you also have to write us a review. So 2 things you have to do. 1, answer the question and send your answer, the right answer, into podcast@emarketer.com. And 2, write a review, a podcast review on Apple Podcasts or some other place, and send us proof of that review, like a screenshot of that review. If you've already written us a review, then just answer the question and send us a screenshot of the review you've already written. If you do those 2 things, answer the question, write a review for us, we'll send you a free Behind the Numbers mug. They're very cool. I'm trying my best to steal one at the moment. Very hard to get, even if you host the show, which is very upsetting. But look out for the question of the month. Rules and regulations of the contest are linked in the show notes. All right, it's time now for Uncommon Knowledge. Welcome to Uncommon Knowledge, the segment where we offer up some unpopular or atypical opinions about things. We start with an unpopular opinion from the BBC Radio 1 feature this was inspired by, and then an unpopular opinion from the internet. Finally, we get an unpopular opinion from one of our panel related to the media world. We start with our first unpopular opinion comes from BBC Radio 1. This one is, it's more comfortable.
It's insane.
It's more comfortable. If anyone agrees with this, then you're instantly kicked off the show. Not just for now, but probably forever. It's more comfortable if you sit sideways in the bath.
God, where do, who's coming up with this stuff?
Maybe with your legs sticking out.
Who fits?
Yeah.
No. I think they mean tucked up. I think because Lady Gaga was on this BBC Radio 1 feature, and she wasn't, this wasn't her opinion, but the caller was speaking to her, and Lady Gaga immediately was like, yeah, absolutely. You got a back support, better back support, tuck your legs up.
Wouldn't you drown?
Probably. Oh, this is a terrible one. Let's move on. I can't be around this one anymore. Okay, one from the internet. Mushrooms are the work of the devil and should stay in the ground. That's a bit much for mushrooms.
I mean, is that just mushrooms in general or related to eating them?
I don't know.
You know, I love me some mushrooms, but there are a lot of bad mushrooms out there. You know, not every mushroom tastes good. Let's just say that.
Okay.
Kind of agree. Right. Kind of agree.
I'm kind of indifferent on mushrooms. Definitely don't feel this strongly about them. The work of the devil?
Yeah, that's a bit extreme.
Person's not bad off.
A little bit.
Oh my goodness. All right, let's move past that one too. What are these this week? All right, let me hit you with one. Okay, we've got one from our panel, and it's me this week. So I apologize in advance. The best we could do. This one is from, so me and Victoria, who edits the show, is her full name. We were at Podcast Movement, which is a podcast conference, last week in LA for a couple of days, and we learned a bunch of stuff. And one of the things that I learned, I was sitting in the first session by Edison Research, and they do the infinite dial. It's something they do every single year. It's, as they say, America's longest running survey of digital media consumer behavior in America, tracked every year since 1998. They come up with a bunch of different trends on smartphone adoption, social media usage, things like that. And one of the things that they cover is podcast stats. And the gentleman who was presenting, one of the stats that jumped out to me was he was saying monthly listenership of podcasts in 2018 was 26%. So 2018, it was 26%. 2020 went from 26% to 37. So in 2 years, gone from 26 to 37, 2020. Then it jumps again to in 2021 from 37 to 41. So we're still climbing. But this year, we've only had a few months of this year, but I think they do the survey. We obviously do a survey at the start of the year. 2022, it falls. So monthly listenership of podcasts, 41% of Americans, I think it's 12 plus, but 41% of Americans in 2021 listened to a podcast monthly. This year, it was 38%. So it's ticked down by a few points. So it's the same this year as it was in 2020, pretty much. So it's gone up a bit and then down a bit. And he seemed to believe that it's just going to go back up again. And he was kind of saying that people are back, a lot of people rush back to work, kids went back to school. And so there was this kind of recalibration of behavior. And that once people settle into those new or pre-existing routines, that podcast listenership should just continue to go up. And I don't agree with him. I think that actually it might have found, I don't know if the highest watermark, but I think it might have settled down a bit. And we're not going to see the kind of growth that we have been seeing. I mean, 26% in 2018. And it was 41 in 2021. So in 3 years, went from 26 to 41. I don't think it's going to keep climbing and climbing in terms of listenership. Same with weekly listenership as well, just to mention. Sorry, Oscar. So it went 22% 2019, 28% 2021, and then ticked down a few points this year.
Well, it's interesting, actually, that you mentioned the I was going to talk about frequency there. It's interesting that there was that slight drop with even the weekly listening. I mean, I do think it, yeah. Marcus, maybe I disagree with you a little bit. It could slightly be, remember, this return to normalcy we're seeing, you know, 2022 is... It finally does feel a little bit like we're coming out of that pandemic impacted, you know, day-to-day type of activities. So it could slightly be that. But as we would say on the forecasting team, margin of error, you know, it is only 2 to 3 percentage points there. It could just be kind of that. So yeah. That would mean maybe it's more flat. So I'm kind of in the middle there. I am curious. I wouldn't be surprised by whatever data. If we see it grow again next year, I would not be surprised by that.
Oscar, we have our own numbers, right, for podcast listeners?
We do.
What do our own figures say?
We do show some growth there. We're not showing any sort of decline or contraction right. in the future. But yes, I do think the strongest growth is probably a little bit behind us at this stage. But, you know, people are very interested in podcasts. And as we know, even with just video content, you're one hit away from seeing that number explode again.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, our podcast numbers, what we estimate is this year, about 37% of Americans are listening to podcasts at least once a month. We think that that'll go up to about 43% by 2026. So it's going up about a percentage and a half, you know, each year up till 2026.
Interesting. Okay. So, but it has, there is that kind of general kind of slowdown over the growth curve of the next couple of years. Because that's what I thought, is that it's approaching the halfway mark in terms of half the country listening to podcasts, but it is starting to level off.
Absolutely. And we see when looking at just audio, digital audio listeners in general, it'll approach that 2 out of 3, but about 1 in 3 of audio listeners might not really be interested in podcasts ever. You know, they might just want to stick strictly to music.
Okay, because awareness, familiarity with podcasts was continuing to go up, and that does make sense. And I'm not saying that I think it's going to go down necessarily. I just don't think we're going to see the kind of growth that he was expecting. But any other thoughts?
I don't know. Just regardless, I'm glad that the entirety of my job isn't based on podcasting, unlike Marcus.
Thanks. They're listening to all podcasts, not this one. No one's leaving this one. Our numbers look very good. Thank you for listening to the show. Please don't leave, because honestly, that's my job. All right. If you stop listening, then I lose my job. Think about it, listeners. Think about it.
Think about it. You have that. You don't want to listen, don't let the listeners know that they have that power. They hold that power.
I know. I know. Please don't go anywhere. I need this. I'm just kidding. Rahul, do you have anything?
Oh, no, I just was thinking that it was interesting that I think at the onset of the pandemic, there were a lot of concerns that podcast listening would plummet because people weren't commuting, mm-hmm. but it sounds like it went up. So I don't know if people are spending more time at home and maybe the decline is a reflection of people emerging back into the world, but maybe not returning to their previous pre-pandemic behaviors of a commute. And that's why you're not seeing as much as high a listenership as you were prior to the pandemic.
Yeah. Yeah, we'll see. I mean, to Oscar's point, it's just 1 year of data and it is within a margin of error. So maybe it's a blip, maybe not. But so we've got time for uncommon knowledge. It's time now for dinner party data. It's the part of the show where we tell you about the most interesting thing that we've recently learned. We start with Blake because he's this week's winner of the Game of the Week. Blake, talk to us.
So an interesting YouGov survey came out a couple of weeks ago about the popular puzzle Wordle. Has anybody talked about this on the podcast yet?
Nope.
So Wordle,
I still don't know what it is.
It's a word game, basically. Like, you have, like, I think five chances to guess, like, which word, and, like, you pick the letters, and it tells you if, like, that's the right letter, if you have a letter that's in the word but it's in the wrong place, or if it's not, and you basically have five chances. It's a fun game. So they did a bunch of research on, you know, when people play Wordle, because the new one comes out at midnight every night, and 11% of the people who play start playing either at midnight or shortly thereafter, but most people play it between 9 a.m. and 12 p.m., so it's like a morning routine thing. The best that you've... They also ask, what's the best that you've ever correctly guessed a word in Wordle? 4% have gotten on the first try, but that's all luck. That doesn't take any skill. 29% on the second guess, which is my personal best. And then on the third guess, 33% that say that was their best score. They're, you know, pretty good percentages of 4 and 5. And on the sixth guess, I guess it goes up to 6 guesses. But if you don't get the Wordle by the fourth guess, you haven't really won, in my opinion. That's kind of a concession. And then the last, which I think is interesting, just because, you know, the New York Times sort of, you know, famously just bought Wordle kind of right when it blew up for, I guess, what it was reported as like low seven figures. It's a lot of money. But 76% of the people who play Wordle say that they would not be willing to pay for Wordle. So it's going to be interesting to see, you know, what the New York Times, which monetizes, you know, basically all of its content, including the digital crossword, which is, you know, it's most famous for, what they're going to do with Wordle to try and, you know, make a little bit of return on that investment.
Yeah. Interesting. All right.
I'm a Wordler, but they lost my...
You're a what now?
I play Wordle, but okay, they lost my streak. They lost it. They ruined... Yes, it was like over 60 days, so I am anti-Wordle now. Never will play again.
Is that proof?
I'm at like 50 my streak, and it infuriates me because the first time I played it, I lost because I'm colorblind, and I thought that the yellow was green.
Oh no.
Rahul, would you play?
I don't enjoy games that make me feel stupid, so I mainly stick to Candyland.
Now we're talking. Rahul, what have you got for us?
Sure, this is a callback to your earlier question about whether tech is losing its magic. I was curious to know what VCs thought, and the answer is, in 2021 at least, yeah, they think... you know, tech still got the magic. According to CB Insights, startups raised $621 billion from VCs globally last year. That was more than double the previous year.
Wow.
Yeah, it's incredible. Startups in the U.S. accounted for about half that total, or about $311 billion. And CB Insights also found that startups outside of traditional tech hubs like Silicon Valley and NYC were getting more early stage deal activity. So that means like there are more early stage startups launching in cities like Dallas, Philly, Los Angeles, and Miami. And as CB Insights, or at least the Bloomberg article that cited the data, thought maybe that was a little bit, at least due to the boom in remote work, kind of dispersing the tech scene across the country.
Okay, so you said it's double what it was in 2020. Is that, I guess that can mean one of two things, or maybe both. It could mean that, okay, well, 2020 was probably a low year, and so it's can't read too much into that. Or you could read, well, actually, regardless of where we land in 2020, it's bouncing back significantly well.
Yeah, I think if I remember correctly, this was a record-setting year and outpaced 2019, which was maybe in second place. So this is a new standard.
Okay.
And my takeaway was, you know, even though I'm bearish on the tech industry, people with a lot more money and intelligence than I have are not. They're going full on in.
Right. Very good.
I would say, and we've been analyzing the tech industry on the ad side and their expenditures, and they have been spending, you know, through the pandemic, leading the pack there. So it doesn't surprise me to hear this data.
Mm-hmm. Very good. Rahul, Oscar, what you got for us?
All right. Well, here at II, we're always thinking about the impact social media has on people, you know, how brands are targeting users on there, what users want to see, what their favorite TikTok videos are. But we forget that social media sort of as a concept is still fairly new. And with anything new, we really don't know what the long-term effects of use are. So I always love studies like this. So I found a study. It was in Nature Communications, a UK study actually, about teenage social media use and how that's linked to life satisfaction for some. So it, what it showed really is the same pattern for boys and girls aged 14 to 15 as those 19 and 20. So no difference when we think of gender there. So scientists speculate, you know, the vulnerability of social media can be linked to, you know, just the brain and hormonal changes and things happening through adolescence development. So really interesting. What researchers from the universities, which were part of the study of Cambridge, Oxford, some of the biggest universities in the world, said that it's really up to social media companies to start providing data to allow scientists to research this again, because this is all still fairly new, last 20 years or so. A couple more things about the study. So they surveyed a large sample size. It was 72,000 people in UK households, and they were asked how satisfied they were in life and how much time they spent talking to friends on social media. So, and this was over 7 years, from 2011 to 2018. Yeah, so it was a long time survey, which we love on the forecasting team, for example. And a couple of things they found: 16 to 21 year olds who said they had no or very high use, so more than 7 hours daily. Over time, they reported lower life satisfaction than those who only spent about 3 hours or less on social media. Those younger than that showed a different pattern, but overall, pretty much the same declining life satisfaction with greater social media use. And they even looked at 11 to 13 year olds, and the trend was kind of the same. So we know, you know, everything that you do needs to come, you know, with a limit. You can't overdo it. And I think that's the same with social media. So really interesting study here.
Yeah, fascinating. Really hard to tell whether there is a link between the two, between how people feel and the use of social media, because you can prove correlation. It's hard to prove causation, but longitudinal studies will help to prove for some of that. Yeah. All right, very good. I got one for you real quick. According to the Library of Congress, while the colonies may have established it, America was given a name long before. America is named after Amerigo
Vespucci.
Vespucci, very good. The Italian explorer who set forth the then revolutionary concept that the lands that Christopher Columbus sailed to in 1492 were part of a separate continent. A map created in 1507 by Martin Waldseemüller was the first to depict this new continent with the name America, a Latinized version of Amerigo. Is that something that you guys learned in schools, or you picked it up later?
I think they taught us that, yeah.
I mean, I knew that we were, I mean, America was named after Amerigo Vespucci. I have no idea where I learned that.
Okay. Fascinating.
Beautiful name.
Yeah. What, America? Let's go. That's all we've got time for. That's all we've got time for today's episode. Thank you so much to my guests. Thank you to Rahul.
Thanks, guys.
Thank you, Oscar.
Thanks for having me.
And thank you to Blake, this week's winner of the Game of the Week.
Thanks, everyone.
Thank you to Victoria. She edits the show. And thanks to everyone listening. To ask us questions or just say hi, you can email us at podcast@emarketer.com. We'll see you guys on Monday, hopefully, for the Behind the Numbers Daily and eMarketer podcast made possible by mParticle. Happy weekends. Directors of Reports Editing?
Yeah.
Is that right?
I think so.
I love Rahul's reaction.
Honestly, my title sounds so stupid to me. Director of Reports Editing? Like, what does that mean?
It does kind of sound like your title needs to be edited a little bit.